Time has come once again for Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Rowan, be with you till 9 o'clock. Oh my God, what a great song, the Chambers Brothers. Time Has Come Today from their amazing album, The Time Has Come. Did you check out those lyrics? We're going to be talking about time today. I'm going to be talking about time today. I hope you all want to join in at 503-231-8187. Time. Yeah, so I've kind of been obsessing on time. I think it has to do with getting older. I don't know. Has to do with a life experience. Has a lot to do with coming back to KBOO and doing the show and getting immersed in information about climate change. There's something very, very strange and bizarre. I think I referred to it in an interview with Paul Beckwith, who actually, by the way, is going to be on hopefully next week, if not the week after, the climate change, sudden climate change specialist, graduate student, professor up in Ottawa. So stay tuned for that. I'll put that up on the KBOO website as soon as I know for sure. Anyway, revert to it as the twilight zone effect that we seem to be going on in our institutional life, even though everything is so out of whack, as we can all plainly sense. We still go along institutionally. There's something about institutions that's very strange. They sort of resist reality to some extent. They resist the flux of time. So we're in these boxes, these bubbles. KBOO might be one of them. We're all in them. Portland is famously known as one of them. And reality is going on. And it's, you know, we talk about things as if, you know, something's going to happen by 2025 or 2050 or whatever, when in reality, the possibility that these methane clathrates on the, especially on the Siberian continental shelf, can go off at basically any time. We don't know when. The last time they went off, they caused a massive cataclysm. it's kind of like this sword of Damocles or this ticking time bomb. Anyway, and even without the clathrates, the amount of carbon dioxide already in the atmosphere and that we've already committed to the atmosphere, we're already committed to unknown catastrophes. So anyway, it's been messing with me, you know, because I still am a, you know, I'm ingrained as an activist. I kind of came of age politically with Earth First and, you know, some real successes that we had in the effort to protect the forest. You know, the movement itself kind of got co-opted and derailed by the big green groups. But nevertheless, that groundswell of direct action mobilizations succeeded in shaking things up and succeeded in creating an unprecedented, if, as I said, flawed and undermined by a political compromise, a framework that actually did drastically slow down the cutting, at least in the Pacific Northwest forests. Unfortunately, forests all over the world continue to be decimated. So anyway, I still have that framework of, you know, we can just, if we just apply enough pressure, if we just do enough direct actions. But up against us is this huge mechanism of the global climate system that is working its way regardless of what we're doing. I'm not saying we can't still at this point change the course of things through dramatic action, but the dramatic action is just not happening. So anyway, so I've thought a lot about time, this collision course between sort of human social constructs of time and the constructs of our industrial civilization that have led to this massive disturbance of our global ecosystems. That going up against the construct that we're sort of trapped in, these institutional constructs of time and our socialized awareness, consciousness, the limitations thereof, and these large processes, physical processes that are going on. So that's one. Then, you know, the time frame of capitalism, the strange way that capitalism has appropriated time, the fact that basically capitalism only really exists in the imaginary. It's a strange statement, I know, but in the sense that it's a pyramid scheme, the way that capitalism functions is that it has to keep going in order to pay off those who have invested in it. So it's essentially a pyramid scheme. So what's driving was driving fossil fuel extraction all around the world, like the tar sands, fracking, is basically they have to continue to do it to pay off these insane investments that have been made, banking on that they're going to be paid off by the extraction of those fossil fuels. So the investment in pipelines, in all the infrastructure of support for this whole process, and, you know, futures tradings, all this crazy capitalist stuff. So that is in, again, direct conflict with real time, the time of organic processes, mineral processes, meteorological processes. There's some basic conflict between human mental workings and the basic functionings of this world we live in. So I'm going to read from some things. I'm going to read from a new piece by the Invisible Committee. Anybody out there been reading the Invisible Committee? The Coming Insurrection, To Our Friends, and other things? All right, so I'm going to read. This is just translated. I just picked this up off the internet. You can too. It's called Now by the Invisible Committee. I'm going to read first something near the end and then kind of work back up to it, because I think, to me, this is sort of really a crucial segment. Again, give me a call after I've gotten through with this a fair amount. And the number is 503-231-8187. Okay, here we go. Hope. This very light but constant impulse towards tomorrow that is communicated to us day by day is the best agent for the maintenance of order. We are daily informed of problems about which we can do nothing, but for which there will surely be solutions tomorrow. The whole crushing sentiment of powerlessness that this social organization, that is the society we live in, cultivates endlessly in each of us is nothing but an enormous lesson in waiting. It is a flight from the now. There never was, there is not, and never will be anything but the now. And even if what was formerly exercises some effect on the now, it is because what was formerly was never anything itself except a now, as tomorrow will be. The only way to understand something in the past is to understand that it was also a now, is to feel the weak breath of air in which the women and men of yesterday lived. If we are so inclined to flee the now, it is because it is the place of the decision. It is the place of the I accept or the I refuse. It is the place of the logical gesture that immediately follows perception. It is the present and thus the place of presence. It is the instant, ceaselessly repeated, of taking a position. To think in distant terms is always more comfortable. In the end, things will change. In the end, beings will be transfigured. Meanwhile, let us continue as we are. Let us remain what we are. A spirit that thinks in terms of the future is incapable of acting in the present. She/he does not seek change. She/he avoids it. The current disaster is like the monstrous accumulation of all the deferred moments in the past, to which is added in a permanent landslide that of each day and of each instant. But life is always played out now, and now, and now. And I could finish that with the last paragraph of this piece, but I wanted to read a bit more of it to give you the fullness what they're talking about. And boy, I can identify with that. I feel like my life, current life, is almost like the accumulation of all the deferred moments of the past. Who among us does not have that insight every now and then in the middle of the night when we wake up and can't get back to sleep? All right, so here we go. It's useless to wait for a breakthrough, for the revolution, the nuclear apocalypse, or a social movement. To go on waiting is madness. The catastrophe is not coming. It is already here. We are already situated within the collapse of a civilization. It is within this reality that we must choose sides. That's the Invisible Committee from their earlier piece, The Coming Insurrection. With this post, we begin the this is the translator's note. With this post, we begin the translation in English of the Invisible Committee's most recent essay, Maintenant, Now, following on the coming insurrection into our friends. And we do so because of the importance that we attribute and have attributed to their ongoing reflections on interventions in our world. Each post will be a chapter of the work. What follows then is the first of seven. Tomorrow is canceled. And I hear that I already have a caller, Roberto. If you can just hang on, I'm just going to get through a few paragraphs of the beginning of this piece. Tomorrow is canceled. All the reasons for carrying out a revolution are present. None is missing. The sinking of politics, the arrogance of the powerful, the reign of the false, the vulgarity of the wealthy, the cataclysms of industry, rampant poverty, naked exploitation, ecological apocalypse. We are spared nothing, not even that of being informed. Quote, climate, 2016 breaks the heat record, tells us Le Monde on its first page, as almost every year nowadays. All the reasons are united, but it is not reasons that make revolutions, it is bodies, and the bodies are all in front of screens. We can watch a presidential campaign sink to the depths, the transformation of the, quote, most important moment of French political life. I was going to say something a little bit about the Invisible Committee. They are from France, but I'll save that till later. The transformation of the, quote, most important moment of French political life into a grand game of massacre doesn't, I guess that must be some sort of game that I don't know of, doesn't render the soap opera any more captivating. Koh-Lanta, French version of the U.S. reality show Survivor, could not be imagined with such characters, nor with such vertiginous twists, with such cruel trials, such general humiliation. The spectacle of politics survives as a spectacle of its decomposition. The incredulity reaches to the very landscapes of filth. The National Front, this political negation of politics, this negation of politics on the terrain of the political, logically occupies the center of the smoking ruins of this political game. Humanity witnesses, bewitched at its own sinking, like at a first-class spectacle. It is so much taken that it does not feel the water lapping at its legs. In the end, it will transform everything into a buoy. Is the destiny of the shipwrecked to transform everything that they touch into a buoy. This world is no longer to be commented on, criticized, denounced. We live surrounded by a fog of commentaries and of commentaries on commentaries, of criticisms and of criticisms of criticisms, of revelations that trigger nothing except revelations about revelations. And this fog takes away from us any hold on the world. There is nothing to criticize in Donald Trump. The worst that one can say about him, he has already absorbed, incorporated. He embodies it. He wears as a necklace all of the grievances that one could ever imagine holding against him. He is his own caricature, and he is proud. Even the creators of South Park throw in the towel. Quote, "It is very complicated now that satire has become reality. We really did try to laugh at what was happening, but we couldn't keep up. What was happening was much funnier than anything that we could imagine. We therefore decided to give up, to let them play their comedy, and we would play our own," end quote. We live in a world that has established itself beyond all justification. Here, criticism can do nothing, no more than satire. They remain without effect. To stick to the denunciation of discrimination, to stick to the denunciation of discrimination and justice and wait to harvest the fruits is to be mistaken about our epoch. The leftists who believe that we can still raise something by working the lever of guilty conscience are very much mistaken. They may very well go into public to scratch at their wounds and make audible their complaints, believing that this will excite sympathy. They will arouse nothing more than disdain and the desire to destroy them. Victim has become an insult in all quarters of the world. There is a social use of language. No one believes it any longer. Its price has fallen to zero, from which comes the inflationary bubble in global jabber. Everything that is social is deceitful. Everyone knows it from now on. It's not only those who govern, the advertisers and the public personalities who, quote, engage in communication. It is every entrepreneur of the self that this society aims to make of each of us, persistent practitioners of the art of public relations. Having become an instrument of communication, language is no longer its own reality, but an instrument in the service of operating on the real, to obtain effects according to different conscious strategies. Words are no longer put into circulation except to travesty things. Everything sails under false flags. Usurpation has become universal. One does not retreat before any paradox. The state of emergency is the state of law. War is made in the name of peace. Bosses offer jobs. Security cameras are apparatuses of video protection. The executioner's torturers complain that they are persecuted. Traitors protest their sincerity and their fidelity. Mediocrities are cited everywhere as examples. There is the real practice on the one hand, and on the other, the discourse, which is an implacable counterpoint with the perversion of all concepts, the universal deceit of oneself and of others. Everywhere, it is exclusively a question of preserving or extending interests. In return, the world is peopled by the silent. Certain among them explode in acts of madness closer and closer to each other by date. Who can be surprised? Don't say anymore, the young no longer believe in anything. Say, damn, they no longer swallow our lives. Don't say anymore, the young are nihilists. Say, damn, if this continues, they're going to survive the collapse of our world. The value of language has fallen to zero, and yet we write. It's because there is another use of language. One can speak of life and one can speak from life. It's not the same language, nor the same style. It's also not the same idea of truth. There is a, quote, courage of truth that consists in hiding behind the objective neutrality of the facts. There is another that considers that a word which leads to nothing, that is worth nothing in itself, that doesn't risk its position, that costs nothing, isn't worth much. All the criticism of financial capitalism is a pale when compared to the smashed window of a bank. Tagged, here are your updates. It's not because of ignorance that the youths appropriate the punchline of rappers in their political slogans rather than the maxims of philosophers. And it is from decency that they don't take up the we renounce nothing that militants cry out at the moment when they renounce everything. It is that some speak of the world while others speak from the world. The true deceit is not that which one does to others, but that which one does to oneself. The first is, in comparison to the other, relatively exceptional. Deceit is refusing to see certain things that one sees, and refusing to see them as one sees them. True deceit are all of the screens, all of the images, all of the explanations which one lets between oneself and the world. It's the way that we daily trample upon our own perceptions, so much so that as long as it will not be a question of truth, it will not be a question of anything. There will be nothing. Nothing except this planetary asylum of fools. The truth is not something towards which we would tend, but a non-evasive relation to what there is. It is not a problem, except for those who already see life as a problem. It is not something that one professes, but a way of being in the world. It is therefore not something that is possessed or accumulated. It is given in a situation from moment to moment. Whoever senses the duplicity of someone, the harmful character of a representation, or of the forces that move beneath the play of images, will strip away whatever hold they have on them. Truth is the full presence to oneself and to the world, the vital contact with the real, the acute perception of the givens of existence. In a world where everyone plays, where everyone is on stage, where one communicates all the more so when nothing is really said, the single word truth chills, irritates, or arouses sneers. Everything that this epic contains of sociability has assumed the habit of supporting itself on the crutches of deceit to the point of not being able to let go of them. There is no need to proclaim the truth. To preach the truth to those who cannot even tolerate slight doses of it is only to expose oneself to their vengeance. In what follows, we in no way pretend to speak of the truth, but of the perception that we have of the world, of what we hold to, of what keeps us standing and alive. Common sense's neck must be twisted. Truths are multiple, but deceit is one, because it is universally leagued against the least little truth that may surface. Well, with that, I will pause. We've still got a little bit to go with this piece. I know radio doesn't make for the best medium to get into these intense philosophical or discourses that really need and deserve to be paid attention to as a whole, because people do come in the middle or even towards the end and may miss some of it. But be that as it may, I hope I at least spark some people to go to find this. It's called Now by the Invisible Committee. It's just recently translated, the recent piece. And well, let's just pause. I'm going to continue to read this. Let's go to our first caller, if Roberta is still with us.
Hi. Good morning. This is Roberta, and I wanted to thank you for playing that song. I am an activist who was created in the 60s, so I'm very familiar with that song. And what was amazing to me, yes, I did listen very carefully to the lyrics. What is so amazing to me about the lyrics is how so much relevant the lyrics are.
Yeah, I was
today,
waiting for
as they were in the 60s and 70s.
I was waiting for a false
amazingly
note.
Relevant.
Yeah, I was waiting for a false note, but I didn't hear a single one.
Exactly. Yeah. So I wanted to thank you for playing that. That is good to hear that, you know, on a lot of levels. I wanted to acknowledge that. And the subject that's on my mind now is relates to your subject of climate change, and it relates to the now because it's something that is happening now, not only on a personal level but on a worldwide level. I live in Wilsonville. I've lived here for 4 years, and I have my apartment facing the Willamette River, so I'm not on the Willamette River, just a ways back, but in a distance from the Willamette River. And I have seen constant chemtrails through this area, and I've gotten into the habit of, since they're not going away, I am going to study them and, you know, see how it's affecting the sky and what how does a cloud that's a chemtrail cloud differ from a natural cloud, for instance.
So you're talking about the vapor trails that airplanes leave?
No, not the vapor trails. Those are contrails. That's different from chemtrails.
Well, you know, this is a subject that I've never really gotten into just because of the thorniness of it. But, you know, I've read refutations of the idea of chemtrails that I find rather compelling. I mean, do you have the idea of evidence? I mean, this is really getting away actually from the reading I've been doing, but I'm willing to entertain it. But I have not read a very convincing argument for the actual. I haven't seen a smoking gun evidence that there are actual chemicals being loaded into airplanes and then put out the exhaust or whatever, or however they supposedly distribute them with these airplanes. Do you have such a piece of evidence?
No, I don't.
Okay.
I'm telling you what my empirical evidence is based on having looked at the sky for 66 years and being able to tell the difference between what's natural, what's natural.
Well, of course they're not natural. They come out of airplanes.
The color, exactly, the color and the texture and the constant grids that they're painting across the sky and how it's affecting the weather, the color of the clouds. And yesterday, for the first time, I saw what I would call the San Francisco effect. I lived in San Francisco. And
well, listen, Roberta, I do want to get back to the subject that I introduced. I appreciate the call, but what we really need are some like actual evidence, because if you read some various accounts that actually seem to do account for the duration of these vapor trails, that apparently they're the different meteorological conditions account for how long they actually last. And the fact that their grids seems to be, from what I've read, actually the effect of there being such a large volume of airplane traffic that just exists in our world today,
right,
which
right,
itself
right.
is a large contributor to climate change.
Right. Well, before I go then, I can give you one very good website to go to give you the scientific evidence that you would need to look
okay.
at it at a different perspective, and it's called geoengineering.com. It might be .org.
Oh, yeah, I've been to that site.
Go to geoengineering.com or .org.
Yeah, I've been to that
for
site.
For that
yeah.
scientific evidence
okay.
that you're looking for.
Thank you very much. All right. Well, again, the number is 503-231-8187. If there's anyone who wants to take up the issue of time and the now, and what I've been reading from the Invisible Committee. Perhaps some of you would like me to keep reading. But until someone calls, that is what I will do. So I'm just going to carry on where I left off. We are kept up to date on the thousands of threats that surround us: terrorists, endocrine disruptors, migrants, fascism, unemployment, and thus the imperturbable routine of capitalist normality is perpetuated. Against the background of thousands of unsuccessful plots, hundreds of postponed catastrophes, it has to be recognized that the riot has the paradoxical virtue of liberating us from the livid anxiety that one tries to inoculate us with. Day after day, with armed military patrols, breaking news, and government announcements, It is what the amateurs of those funeral processions called demonstrations cannot understand. Those who around a glass of red wine taste the pleasure of their defeat. Those who let go of a flatulent, or else this is going to blow, before wisely returning to their bus. In the street confrontation, the enemy has a clear face, whether in civilian clothes or in armor. She-he has largely known methods. She-he has a name and a function. She-he is additionally called a functionary, as she-he declares soberly, soberly. The friend also has gestures, movements, and a recognizable appearance. There is in the riot an incandescence of the presence to self and to others, a lucid fraternity that the Republic is very well incapable of arousing. The organized riot is equally able to produce what this society is incapable of engendering, living in irreversible ties. Those who stop before the images of violence always miss what is at play in the fact of together taking the risk to smash, tag, confront the police. One never leaves one's first riot untouched. It is this positivity of the riot that the spectator prefers not to see, and which in the end frightens her him far more than the damage, the charges, and the countercharges. In the riot, there is the production and affirmation of friendships, direct configurations of the world, clear possibilities of action, ready to hand means. The situation has a form, and one can move within it. The risks are clear. In contrast to all of the nebulous risks that governments take pleasure in making hang over our existences, the riot is desirable as a moment of truth. It is a momentary suspension of the confusion. In the gas, things are curiously clear, and the real is finally readable. It is difficult, then, not to see who is who. Speaking of the day of insurrection on the 15th of July, 1927, in Vienna, in the course of which proletarians burned the Palace of Justice, Elias Canetti said, quote, "It is what I lived closest to a revolution. Hundreds of pages would not suffice to describe everything that I saw," end quote. It would serve as the inspiration for his chef d'oeuvre, I guess that's his main work, Crowds and Power. The riot is formative through what makes us see, through what it makes us see. There was in the English Navy this old toast, confusion to our enemies. Confusion has a strategic value. It is not by chance. It scatters wills and prohibits their renewed reassembly. It has the taste of the ashes of defeat, whereas the battle hasn't yet taken place and probably never will. Each of the recent attacks in France is thus followed by a train of confusion, which comes opportunely to increase the government discourse on the matter. Those who claim responsibility for the attacks, those who call for war on those who claim responsibility for them, they all have an interest in our confusion. As for those who execute the attacks, they are often the children of the confusion. This world, I understand I got a caller. If you'll hold on just for maybe I'll read another paragraph or two. This world that babbles so much has nothing to say. It is devoid of affirmation. Perhaps it believed that it thereby rendered itself unassailable, but it above all placed itself at the mercy of any consequent affirmation. A world whose positivity arises from so many ravages well deserves that what is affirmed with life first takes on the form of pillaging, smashing, rioting. We will not fail to be taken as desperate on the grounds that we act, we build, we attack without hope. Hope, here is at least a sickness with which this civilization has not infected us. This is again the writers speaking those lines, the writer called Invisible Committee. We are not nevertheless desperate. No one ever acted through hope. Hope is related to waiting, to refusing to see what there is, to the fear of breaking in on the present, in short, to the fear of living. To hope is to declare oneself in advance without a hold on what one nevertheless expects, is to hold back from the process so as not to be held to the results. It is to want things to be otherwise without wanting the means to make them so. It is cowardliness. One has to know to what one holds and then hold to it, even if to make enemies, even if to make friends. As soon as we know what we want, we are no longer alone. The world peoples itself. Everywhere allies, those close by, and an infinite gradation of possible friendships. Nothing is close by for one who floats. Hope, this very light but constant impulse towards tomorrow that is communicated to us day by day, is the best agent for the maintenance of order. We are daily informed of problems about which we can do nothing, but for which there will surely be solutions tomorrow. The whole crushing sentiment of powerless that this social organization cultivates endlessly in each of us is nothing but an enormous lesson in waiting. It is a flight from the now. There never was, there is not, and never will be anything but the now. And even if what was formerly exercises some effect on the now, it is because what was formerly was never anything itself except a now, as tomorrow will be. The only way to understand something in the past is to understand that it was also a now, is to feel the weak breath of air in which the women and men of yesterday lived. If we are so inclined to flee the now, it is because it is the place of the decision. It is the place of the I accept or of the I refuse. It is the place of the logical gesture that immediately follows perception. It is the present, and thus the place of presence. It is the instant, ceaselessly repeated, of taking a position. To think in distant terms is always more comfortable. In the end, things will change. In the end, beings will be transfigured. Meanwhile, let us continue as we are. Let us remain what we are. A spirit that thinks in terms of the future is incapable of acting in the present. She-he does not seek change. She-he avoids it. The current disaster is like the monstrous accumulation of all the deferred moments of the past, to which is added in a permanent landslide that of each day and of each instant. But life is always played out now, and now, and now. Each one sees that this civilization is like a train heading towards the abyss, and that accelerates. The more it accelerates, the more are heard the drunken hysterical hoorays from the discotheque car. You would have to lend an ear to detect the petrified silence of rational spirits who no longer and understand anything, of those anguished who bite their nails in the false accent of serenity in the intermittent exclamations of those who play cards waiting. Internally, many people have chosen to jump from the train, but they remain on the footboard. They are still beset by so many things, and they feel so held because they have made the choice, but the decision is lacking. For it is the decision that traces in the present the manner and the possibility of acting, of taking a jump that is not into the void. This decision, it is that of the deserter, that of stepping out of the rank, that of organizing oneself, that of secession, be it imperceptibly, but in all cases now. The epoch belongs to the resolute. And that's the end of part one of this, apparently going to be seven parts of this new piece by the Invisible Committee. And I could have some comments on that, but let's go to a caller. Go ahead, you're on the air. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Yes.
Is this the KBOO show?
Yeah, you're on, man.
I just wanted to say that, what is the name of the thing that you're reading?
It's called Now by the Invisible Committee.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that that's brilliant. Like, I've been listening to it, and I hopped in my car this morning and turned it on, and I had KBOO on, and you were reading that, and it just struck me right away, and I was just like, I was really resonating with it, and it just sounds like just a brilliant piece of writing. What inspired you to read that this morning?
Well, like I said at the very outset, which you may have missed, I've been thinking a lot about time, and I played The Time Has Come Today, the old song by the Chambers Brothers at the outset, and I was reflecting on the strange twilight zone nature of the reality that we're living in, and there's a lot of time is rushing at us, and we're kind of sort of in this strange stasis. And it kind of makes me high reading this. It kind of helps me break through. And I'm not saying I'm any paragon of what they're, you know, I hope they're living what they're talking about here. I certainly am not these days. So I'm just reading this. I don't claim to be in the position of the narrator of this piece.
It's really cool, and I just thought it was kind of ironic that last person who called in and what they were talking about, the subject matter they were bringing up, in context of like what you just were reading about, like the truth, and like how truth become like a word that like you know, incites people, and the idea of people claiming that they know what the truth is. And I just thought that was kind of ironic that that caller called in and was talking about, you know, like stuff that's like a controversial, you know, truth subject. And it's just, it's just weird. We're just in this weird now. We're like, everything that's like, that like is the thing, like is constantly like happening, like on a constant stream. Even within like, you know, a show like this, where you're like reading this, like, just like brilliant piece of, how old is that, by the way?
I think it may be from this year, certainly no later than last year. I mean, I don't know how long it took them to translate it, but it just came across, you know, on my Facebook page. Speaking of being in front of screens, which they talk about how we're all dazed and confused, sitting in front of our screens and being subject to this vast spectacle of disaster. But yeah, so I just came across it. So I assume it's fairly recent.
Nice. Yeah, thanks for reading that in the morning here in Portland. I appreciate that.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. And people can find it for themselves. You know, go to your screen and your keyboard, type in "Now, the Invisible Committee." And again, yeah, they're from France. It's been rumored that they're associated with the people involved in the other publishing project, Tikkun, T-I-Q-Q-U-N, I believe it is. I don't know the truth of that. I think the idea of anonymity is important to them, so I will respect that. But it, yeah, they've been publishing stuff for a number of years. So yeah, 503-231-8187. Anybody else resonate with what I just read? I also been reading another thing called "Against Domestication," an essay about revolution in the future by Jacques Camat, another Frenchman, C-A-M-A-T-T-E. And I thought this was very relevant to what I read. It's part 8, Revolution in the Future. And yeah, so capital enters, being thus attuned to the future enabled him to perceive, he's talking about this guy Bordiga, to perceive the revolutionary movement as it actually was and not according to its own characterizations. Since that time, the future industry has come into its own and assumed an enormous scope. Capital enters this new field and begins to exploit it, which leads to a further expropriation of people and a reinforcement of their domestication. This hold over the future is what distinguishes capital from all other modes of production. From its earliest origins, capitalist relationship to the past or present has always been of less importance to it than its relationship to the future. Kind of relates to what I first was talking about at the outset. Capital's only lifeblood is in the exchange it conducts with labor power. Thus, when surplus value is created, it is, in the immediate sense, only potential capital. It can become effective capital solely through an exchange against future labor. In other words, when surplus value is created in the present, it acquires reality only if labor power can appear to be ready and available in a future. And I would add, what nature can provide itself through, quote, resources. Quote, in parentheses, a future which can only be hypothetical and not necessarily very near. If, therefore, this future isn't there, then the present, or henceforth the past, is abolished. This is devalorization through total loss of substance. Clearly, then, capital's first undertaking must be to dominate the future in order to be assured of accomplishing its production process. This conquest is managed by the credit system. Thus, capital has effectively appropriated time, which it molds in its own image as quantitative time. However, present surplus value was realized and valorized through exchange against future labor. And I say, you know, the ability to extract from nature itself. But now, with the development of the future industry, present surplus value has itself become open to capitalization. This capitalization demands that time be programmed, and this need expresses itself in a scientific fashion in futurology. Henceforth, capital produces time. From now on, where many people situate their utopias and uchronias. Anyway, it goes on. This is Jacques Camatte, C-A-M-A-T-T-E. I really recommend this, from May 1st, 1973. It's called Against Domestication. But I understand we have another caller. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, this is Nick calling from Portland.
Hello.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing it back home to capital and profit because there's some hidden costs here that aren't being recognized, like who owns the atmosphere, right? You're talking about this time state of the past and present. Well, you know, we're burning and extracting fossil fuels from the past, yesterday's sunlight, and putting it into our atmosphere. And there is a cost there, right? Of course, it's not being recognized. We don't have a proper taxation on that kind of cost, right? We tax cigarettes because they are a cost to the healthcare, right? Cigarettes, tobacco is cheap, but the cost to society is immense. And so, again, this will come back to economic markets. I study climate science. I'm a permafrost researcher. I study the methane you were talking about coming out of Siberia. I've spent some time there. And that's not even being brought into our climate models. I mean, it's estimated that about 500 gigatons of this CO2 or methane will be released by 100. And that's not even in our current models right now because of the uncertainties there.
Again,
so we have what was that?
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so we have uncertainties in climate models, but if it's true that it's going to be 500 gigatons, well, that's about 10 years of current, you know, human active anthropogenic fossil fuel use. So we're headed towards a potential catastrophe that, which is interesting, it's kind of dominated by capitalism, but capitalism markets will have to pay for it. I mean, you know, MIT did a study and estimated that it could cost us, you know, by 2050, 2080, you know, $46 trillion on just infrastructure. And eventually we'll pay for it. But the people who are sort of putting this off in their conscious minds, you know, are, say, you know, Rick Perry, the Department of Energy head right now, you know, people who have lobby interest in the oil markets, like you had said, you know, our financial system set up for this. I mean, the petrodollar itself is built upon this principle, right? I mean, our own currency is built on oil production.
Well, let me bring it. Can I just bring it back to the spirit of the essay that I was reading from? Because you brought up two dates, 2100 and 2080. But
yeah,
from what I understand, the very real possibility / probability of these. Well, I mean, there's already large scale methane releases. I mean, there's not much,
right?
There's not much discussion of what's already,
right?
You know, there's a lot of wiggle room. There's a lot of fudge factor because it's difficult to actually, it's somewhat difficult to measure the point source of methane. First of all, there's not enough measuring being done. Second of all, the routes that methane takes to travel, is what I understand, it makes it difficult to identify, you know, is it coming off the Siberian permafrost? Is it bubbling up out of the, you know, the continental shelf? Is it bubbling up out of deeper
it's
ocean?
It's
yeah. So, but when you bring up 2100 and 2080, I kind of react because those are dates that are, again, so far off. And I'm not saying I understand the argument you're making. This is not a criticism of you, but when we do use dates that are that far off, it's sort of, okay, you get what I'm saying.
Yeah. And just to bring it home with your concept of time, I mean, you know, these essays you're reading, which are fantastic. I mean, they borrow heavily from the Situationist movement in France and in the 50s and, you know, Jean-Paul Sartre and the existential movement of identity and the self and how we see ourselves. You know, I would say to the listeners, you know, dive into Lacan, who these essays are a lot of the psychology there, the French concept of identity Death Drive and, you know, theater and Psyche and just all these great things that you're bringing in, and they're kind of all woven together. You know, I mean, as the previous caller said, you know, just the essays really speak to them because people know when they hear truth. And
so you're heading towards a point, though, maybe get to that quick because we have another caller. You're sort of talking about the, you know, these the way that economics doesn't take into account. Where were you heading with that?
Yeah, I just wanted to tie in the paradox of the fact that, you know, capitalism is based off of this principle of these commodities, and there is a hidden cost. And the cost is, what I really want to ask the listeners is, who owns the atmosphere, right? And so when we burn CO2, we're just putting that in there, yesterday's sunlight, we're adding energy. Well, that's going to come at a cost to infrastructure, to society, to people, and that's based off of this sort of market that we have, this sort of this free-reign capitalism, unregulated capitalism, and that's going to come to a cost. We won't have that in the future in 50 or 100 years. I mean, they'll look at that as just insane. Plus, we'll need all these hydrocarbons in the future for smart plastics and things like that. So, you know, I'm hoping that, you know, we can change our economies. But yeah, I'll let another caller go. But, you know, these essays really speak to the crisis of capitalism itself and our energy markets and the human identity and nature and collective what we owe each other, what we owe the planet, and yeah, who owns the atmosphere, and we do, life does.
Okay.
So I'll leave it at that.
Thank you so much. And I would say a crisis of consciousness and our awareness and our allowing others to get in the way of our own awareness and action. Okay, so Dave, you're up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I this is about truth, right?
Whatever you want it to be about, go ahead.
Well, the way I'm reading your reading, I'm African American. I'm in my 50s, and I've been watching Us for a while, probably mostly through the TV. And, you know, I see us all playing our part in a script. When I see police officers, no matter what they do, they get away with murder. White people, I love them. My mom is, you know, half white. When I see white people get away with murder and go to jail, and innocent black people are just gunned down because of a thought in the mind of some racist white cop who's heard it all up until today. He became a cop, so he knows how to be racist. I think we're all playing a script, and I think that they want to see what we'll do. When a police officer goes on TV Channel 8 and says it's okay to lynch black people with a car with no rebuttal, I think all that means something. So tell me what you think. Thank you.
Yeah. I was actually, I had invited another a possible guest that I asked too late. Well, actually, he couldn't do it because he could be on an airplane. Was Ajamu Baraka, who's got an article on Counterpunch. The body count rises in the U.S. war against black people. And another thing I just sort of came across, again, I hadn't really read it, Against Innocence, Race, Gender, and the Politics of Safety by Jackie Wang, really speak to what you were just talking about. And yeah, I mean, I could read a little bit from those, but it's 8:54, and I'm hoping to have Ajamu Baraka on in a couple weeks. Anyway, just the first sentence here, before we can even process the acquittal of the murders of Philando Castile, we hear about another murder of a black person by the police occupation forces. This time, the victim, Charlena Lyles, is a black woman who was also 5 months pregnant. Again, there is anger, confusion, and calls for justice from the black community of Seattle, where the latest killing took place. Many might remember that it was in Seattle where two members of the local black community attempted to call out the racist and hypocritical liberal white community during a visit by Bernie Sanders. Again, I'm a white Euro-American. I'm always a little bit uncomfortable sort of taking on this subject, which is why I hope to have a guest to talk about it with. I know there's also lots of local activists that I should have on. But all that aside, I just wanted to refer these two things to you. The Body Count Rises in the U.S. War Against Black People, a powerful piece on Counterpunch by Ajamu Baraka, B-A-R-A-K-A, and this really, I think, very insightful zine article called Against Innocence, Race, Gender, and the Politics of Safety by Jackie Wang, which you can find. I looked online. Oh, I'm sorry. We got a caller waiting. Jane, you're on the air.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I wish I could expand upon the last caller, but I really just called in to talk about connectography. And I thought that maybe that would be interesting in because of capitalism, that the word connectography has been brought up to discuss the pivot to Asia, and that imperialism is no longer on the battlefield, it's in the boardroom, so that capitalism is going to play a key role in imperialism. For example, China's buying up as many German companies as they can as part of like the new imperialism. That's what I kind of wanted to touch upon. But on the last caller, you know, the wreckage that the slavery of Africa, and of course, I mean, I'm part Slavic, so slavery, you know, I mean, we were the slaves of the Roman Empire. But as far as France is concerned, those are the people who made the Haitians cut down the Haitian forest and for reparations after slavery ended to pay back the French. And then the Opera House was made of some of that forest. They have such a, you know, I mean, they should be critiquing capitalism. They're Indonesia, Vietnam, all of it. They should be critiquing that. But I just, I think that, you know, this goes so deep. And, you know, to me, it's the whole thing back to African Americans. I mean, my thing is Japan and companies. So if you look at Firestone, which is like Ishibashi is the Kennedys of Japan. And when they purchased Firestone in 1988, that was the largest rubber plantation on earth was in Liberia. They paid Charles Taylor. And it's an interesting thing to look into because Japan is not white people.
Okay, we're at the end of the program.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
I just wanted to say it goes deep. And
yeah, we know. All right, well, thank you so much for calling. Always good if you're going to have these really involved thoughts to call a little earlier in the show. But I know I was reading at length, so that was probably difficult. The difficulties of talk radio. So, yeah, let's talk about this more. Anybody want to talk about it? You can call, get in touch with me at Paul R. Kaboo, PaulRKBOO, at gmail.com. I got to get out of here. The Invisible Committee, now, hot off the presses. Check it out on the internet, how the paradoxes within paradoxes within paradoxes, us depending on internet, when we should be out there doing whatever we need to do to break the spell. All right, I'm out of here. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned.